Flowers plugged into the small square by the steps, an iron fence around the plot, careful people. Large brown eyes, her hair up now, sometimes escaping in wisps. The mother exited with the baby in one arm, the stroller in the other. How precisely she placed him, covering his feet with a soft white blanket, adjusting the cushion. She kissed his cheek. She was always smiling. She pushed right by the window where I sat. Later, I'd see a nanny, a neat Filipino woman, walking with him along the sidewalk where he stopped to look at leaves and pointed at dogs, turning his open face up to the nanny to see if she recognized the wonder before them. He wore a yellow sweater with a boat stitched on it and polished Oxfords, a little man, spirited, cunning, and headlong. The nanny had to chase and grab constantly. Twice I saw the father, the boy on his shoulder, bouncing as though he rode a horse, the father exaggerating his gait for the boy's amusement. I was leaving the cafe and came face to face with them. The boy and I locked eyes for an instant, and he smiled. The last time was 2 days after his fourth birthday, a sweltering day in Manhattan. I'd given up and stepped outside the cafe when I saw him down the sidewalk, zooming toward me on a scooter, propelling himself forward rapidly. He was an apparition. The pedestrians parting before him, his long curls blown back, his foot working against the pavement. The florist outside her shop called to him, "Whoa, Colin!" The newsstand agent greeted him, as did a bag lady. He passed by. He was out of a dream. 4.5 years, then I was gone. Europe, reporting, some private government work, my novels, maybe you've heard. Through my sources and later the internet, I found snatches of information. The concerts, a gala hosted, an article on advances in submarine locators. Not much. Then, just last year, I was in Afghanistan, working for the Times. I came across this on the wire service. Colin Adams Knowles, 16, son of Amanda and Edward Knowles, died on August 5th following an accident while rock climbing at Yosemite National Park. He was a student at Horace Mann School, where he excelled in languages and literature. Adopted as an infant, Colin was loved by his family and many friends for his humor, exceptional intelligence, and infectious joie de vivre. In the future, he planned to study architecture. He was a talented pianist, enjoyed tennis and soccer, and was in training to scale Annapurna with a group of fellow hiking enthusiasts. His parents are joined in grief by grandparents Carlos and Josephine Alcazar and Sandra and Philip Knowles, and by a younger sister, Josephine Amanda Knowles. There. You never knew. Now you do. He lived the years he had. I live with him every day. Now you can have, and I don't mean this ironically, the honor to. Margaret. Colin says I must mail it. How can I? She didn't. How can I not? Life can be surreal. I'm churning with this dilemma, and at the same time pulling up my chair at Cipolla Rosa and greeting Susan, Camille, and Julia all high on the frescoes in their apartment and new hairstyles they got in a fancy salon and pistachio gelato and the Feltrinelli bookstore and the bunch of violets they brought me. Everyone buoyant. I remain placid in my loose dress, tight shoes, my legs feeling pumped full of air. Colin and I stroll along the river back to our room. Over us, the transparent full moon, a soap bubble blown by a child. The friends decided to go back to the piazza for a late limoncello. Tomorrow, we'll all take the same train home to San Rocco. I'm amazed at the energy they continue to amass. They seem to have doubled in force since arrival. I'm walking back also with young Colin Knowles, cut short. My Colin turned silent for hours when he read the letter to Mark, aka Calhoun Green. Margaret, why? If only she'd told us. How foolish I was to think she had the hots for Colin, 30 years younger, when she'd instead only taken what comfort she could by transferring a piece of her hurt and longing. Her lost Colin could have become a man like Colin. A writer is a namer. My Colin, architect, must have hit like a stun gun. The letter unlocked dark Margaret, a child kept secret. And after, she carried secrets forward into her life. Overheard. When the kitchen phone rang, we all looked at each other. What? I was at Villa Assunta for dinner, Colin in London until tomorrow. We moved into the living room for dessert. As I grow, I gravitate toward big, soft chairs. This one reminds me of Tito, who used to warm his big feet at the fire as Louisa knitted scratchy red scarves. As I shift the cushion, I think I catch a whiff of his cigar smoke and the odd smell he gave off of freshly cut wood. We're discussing baby names. Lorenzo, Silvia, Flavia, Luca, Ettore, Lia. I like names with character. From a Trevor novel, I remember an Aunt Fitz Eustace, but who would dare saddle a child with that? They all like Della, which keeps sounding right to me, though Colin likes Eunice, lofty and statuesque. Not as romantic in English, Eunice. Tatiana, Susan suggests. She would be a dancer. On the 8th ring, Susan dashes to answer. No one ever uses the landline. For you, Julia, she calls. At the door, she adds, man, with a southern accent, but not Cleve. Julia grimaces as she takes the call. We continue to talk, but overhear Julia's side of the conversation.
This is Julia.
Wade, how did you find this number? She waves from the doorway, mouth wide open, shaking her head, gesturing a thumbs down.
I guess that's true. No place to hide anymore.
She laughs without laughing.
I'm listening. That's right. My friend went to check on her.
Well, he made it his business.
A friend. A good friend. Anyway, that's not the point. He's willing to look further, but I haven't agreed yet.
Wait. He doesn't think it's his business. He was willing to do it for me.
Wade, calm down. You do what you will. He's trying to help.
Well, go. You've made that trip how many times?
She's gone dark before.
I said go. I'll tell Chris you're going.
Yes, Chris. He has a name. I work with him if you need an explanation.
Of course, if you go, I want to hear back.
I do not want Daddy making that trip. It's too much for him. You know how she feels ganged up on. How she makes it our fault for being there?
The last address we had. And there was that friend who called us when she was arrested. You could look for her. Anna Blackwell, I believe.
What?
Wait, what? Wait, have you lost your mind? This is beyond belief. I don't have any idea what to say, so I won't say anything. I'm going to hang up. The house? Well, that is totally up to Daddy. It's his house. Oh, please. What are you talking about? We lived there forever. He even paid the property taxes. You're not entitled to be reimbursed for maintenance. What's wrong with you? No, no, and no. I'm hanging up. Julia clicks off the phone and comes back to the living room with her face in her hands. Was he always without a clue? How did I not see him all those years? You okay? Susan asks. What the hell is happening? We heard you. Probably should have shut the door, but we were afraid. I knew it was Wade when I answered. We were scared of really bad news. Anything from him is bad news. I told Daddy what Chris found out. He ran into Wade at the club bar. They started talking, and Daddy let him know that Lizzie is missing. Now Wade is all over going to California and searching for her. Once again. Well, let him go. Why not? I ask. Something may have happened to her. I don't doubt that. And yes, he's going. That's fine. She can smash his heart all over again. The other news, this is unbelievable. The girlfriend is pregnant. How tacky. Rose something. She's about half his age. How addlebrained can he get? Oh, second chance. He actually said that. What a cliche. Get this. He suggested that she move into our house, which doesn't even belong to us. Or that he move out and Daddy pays him back for all the improvements we've made over the years. And, oh, she's anxious for everything to remain friendly. Christ, does that just beat anything? What comes to mind is a quote from Wallace Stevens. The world is ugly, and the people are sad. I refrain from throwing it into the fray. I'm thinking maybe the woman is in love. Rose. Speaking of names, that one predisposes her toward innocence. Maybe she's thrilled. Who knows what she's been told, I say. Handsome dude, Wade, even at 60. I've looked him up online at his marine store. Hair blown back, strong hands on the rudder, shirt open. Looks like he stepped out of GQ. I'd turn my head to look at him. I'm sure Rose is projecting, and part of that involves a filmy, can't we all be friends? He does sound opaque. Or, as Margaret said, if they're not sleeping with you, you're history. Julia plops down with a huge sigh. 2 steps forward, 3 back. Now that it's sinking in, I'm glad he's going to look for Lizzie. And he's acting stupid, but I know he also has a big hole in his heart. Now that sweet thing is with child, he's feeling huge guilt over Lizzie again. What a freaking train wreck. She's the lining in a coat I can't take off. Julia, I laugh. Can I use that line? Now, seriously, I think something might happen. Allow yourself a sliver of hope. I say this because of the baby in question. I know what a powerful reordering takes place as soon as that swab turns pink. Sometimes change engenders more change. This I don't mention. Not the time. You know, I do say, now he's on a set path away. This frees you. Even if it's still painful, it cuts you loose. Wide-eyed, Julia looks at me. Right. True. But how impossible to think. And I know this is irrational. that he could make a life without me. I'm the one he once drove 22 straight hours to see. She doesn't say, I'm the one he licked from little toe to ear, he who many times cried after sex. I'm always waiting for the scattered pieces to reform into the shape they should have. I have this recurrent dream that I'm on a busy corner waiting for him to pick me up and we'll go home. I feel like I'm falling into a big relapse. No, that is not happening, Susan says. He can't throw you away like this. We just won't allow it. Why didn't he go to San Francisco and let you know later? He still wants you to suffer with him. And maybe he didn't mean to, but the whole pregnant girlfriend info shouldn't have been part of this conversation. He's a man without borders. Camille brings in a pot and pours big cups of American coffee. Decaf, she says. Drink up. Julia, you've been thriving. Keep at it. Right now, try to focus on what moves you forward. You've walked over coals for Lizzie. What happens to her now is her call. And Wade, her voice softens. What you had, you don't have anymore. You are right. Now all I have to do is believe you. Let's move on to another square, I say. Tomorrow I want to take you on a walk that leads to a Roman bridge hardly anyone ever sees. We walk out from the spur of your land and straight down a rocky path across the valley into an overgrown area where this arc of a stone bridge crosses a torrente that must have once been wilder and more ferocious. This time of year it will be running. Julia looks up. Yes, get back on the horse. Shall we take a picnic? Are you sure you can walk on rough terrain? She feels thrown from her gelding when she was 12. She and horse flying over the jump, that moment in the air, and then the fall. Lucky she only had a dislocated shoulder. Yes. There's a path out to the valley road. We can get Colin to pick us up. The walk back up isn't easy. Good night, you three. A domani. Yes. See you tomorrow. And I hope Julia sleeps. Marvels. Not without trepidation, after completing 18 paper doors, Camille packs them to show to Mathilde, who takes a break when Camille comes in holding two large boxes. She's teaching a small group of African nuns who want to repair damaged texts in church archives. Leaning over a single sheet, the five starched white habits look like petals of a large flower, their heads almost touching in the center. Mathilde's students all fall in love with the process of papermaking, and as a bonus, some adore the more important work of her restoration projects, which are the Bottega's raison d'être. Stepping into the work in progress, Camille feels awkward. Shouldn't her own paintings dissolve into oblivion? Mathilde and Serena have dismantled the five-panel altarpiece from the San Rocco Duomo and spread the pieces on tables. Camille looks through the microscope at the intricate, incised gold work around the figures. Mathilde then shows her what a swipe of cleaner reveals about the color of Saint Jerome's garment. Murky pond green turns bright viridian. Humbling, Camille says, that you can save this work. It feels like an operating room here. What's the brown mark? She's fascinated enough to forget her own meager paintings. Candle damage. That's hard. Not only wax, but see this? Mathilde shines the lamp onto the blackened spot on the saint's shoulder. This damage goes down to the wood. I must repair the gesso. I use mordants. Ugh, you smell them? Rabbit glue and fish glue.
She recaps the odorous elixirs. On the wall is a large photograph of the altarpiece, with name tags pinned to various sections. Serendipitously, the students of papermaking, who see her painstaking and loving work, are also saving this crucial piece of the Italian patrimony. Mathilde has devised a plan so that a single person can sponsor a sector of the restoration. She stands in front of the photo, pointing to Mary's cloak.
Who wouldn't want to save that blue? Expensive ground lapis lazuli.
See, only $2,500 for restoring a minor saint, but $6,500 for an accompanying angel, and much more for a major saint.
A class could go in together for a section.
They're thrilled that their names will be listed on a plaque when the altarpiece is at last restored to its hallowed place above the altar. All this in Italian, which Camille somehow understands.
Enough. What's in your boxes? You came not for a restoration lesson.
I wanted to show you what I've been working on. What becomes of all the paper I lug home? But you're busy.
Not at all. Let's look.
At an empty table, Camille lays out her paper doors around the periphery. After only a glance, Mathilde's eyes widen. She walks around, examining and repeating, Dio mio, and Madonna. Serena, coming downstairs, stops short as she sees the doors on the table.
Camille, what have you done? Where did these come from?
The nuns gather around too, nodding, chattering in their language. Mathilde stops swearing. Camille, arms crossed, frowning, stands to the side.
These are marvelous. In the real sense, marvels, small miracles. I'm dazzled.
Mathilde keeps gliding around the table, murmuring and smiling.
I'm not sure how to think about this work, because I've never seen anything like it.
Camille feels equally thrilled and wanting to disappear. She's unaccustomed to attention.
Mathilde is saying in English, We must cause a show.
Camille shrugs and looks shocked. For all his virtues, Charles never insisted that she pay attention to the work she was intensely engaged with when they met. Mutually, they fell into a lifestyle. Lovely, it was, but how could she have displaced her own interests? Before Charlie was born, there were the trips to New York when she was newly wed and still determined. Oh, yes, Cyrus. A classmate, former boyfriend at UVA, up there doing well. His friends, all committed and living in roach-infested cold water dumps. The shock of shame she felt in every corpuscle after his show, when they went out to bars and then to his bare loft. Charles at home in their two-bedroom apartment, going over briefs at the folding table where they ate. What was she thinking? They laughed, smoked weed, and even though she privately thought his work was superficial, she praised his huge white canvases with slashes of built-up white impasto. He was selling to all the cool collectors. Mattress on the floor. The sex was inspired, much more than his art. She went home. She felt she'd been on a moonwalk. She ran a fever. Charles's big hug and smile. He had made spaghetti and wanted to hear about her weekend. How could she? Later, she knew she was pregnant. She did not know if Charles was the father.
agony. Cyrus calling, "Come back!"
She never told him.
And outrage, the IUD lodged inside her. Could she let a stupid knight's indiscretion govern her life and the life of a child? He, she, would be born, and she would be scanning the features? Who's the father?
No. On her own, through a sorority sister who was a nurse, she arranged an abortion. She went alone to Charlotte, ostensibly to visit a college roommate. After the procedure, she spent the night at an airport hotel, crying and watching movies and eating nuts from the minibar. How could she betray Charles? She was untrustworthy. She became trustworthy. All that tennis, lavish attention to her classes. She barely could look at her own corner area of canvases and paints. She strove for perfection in her home, her marriage, her job.
April, Matilda says, when the tourists return. The little gallery on the piazza, I will talk to them. Can you leave the doors here for a few days?
Yes, and I want to give you one. Please choose.
No, Matilda answers. You cannot give these away.
Just the same response Rowan gave at Christmas. Rowan. Too long until he's back.
Rowan had seemed transfixed. Matilda, too.
Matilda, grazie. I'm kinda stunned. I'm totally excited that you like them.
Camille, you have no idea how much. And I see a lot of original art.
Camille walks home slowly. There will be a show. Julia will throw a celebratory dinner. Susan will fill the house with flowers, and maybe Rowan will be back. If I'd stayed, she thinks, nothing would have happened. She imagines her paper doors hanging on the walls all around the gallery off the piazza. People will wander in and out, sign a guest book. Opinions will form. Someone may want to buy. But could I sell? How do artists let go of something so intimate? Or maybe the five nuns and my teachers at the bodega are anomalies, and no one else will like the work. They'll be polite, and I'll know. Wait. Rowan loved them. My friends do. Charlie did. Even Laura. Why, when the goodies were passed around, did I not get a fucking ego? How do I repair that? She mused. From the road, she looked out over the valley flushed with early spring greens, ripples of shadows like gray pleats in the hollows, and the fast-lowering sun falling into its own sifted gold light. She tries to pick out the secret Roman bridge Kit showed them, but she can detect only the white rush of falling water downstream. Kit has moxie. Kit presses on regardless. The others, too. Everyone feels more confidence in their new paths than I, she thinks. Regardless, I have moved into my art. I'm exhilarated. I just have to get used to the public part. Put it out there. When she arrives home, she checks her messages. Matilda already has scheduled the local gallery, and she's contacted Rowan with JPEGs of all the paper doors. He responded immediately that he will prepare a catalog. He wants Kit to write an intro. She has three messages from him. Julia meditatively stirs a pot of ragu, while Susan has gone momentarily insane, playing with the kittens and a piece of string.
Momentous news, Camille announces.
There's no one she'd rather celebrate with than Susan and Julia. After, She tells them what snagged her art. The easy abortion. Oh, yeah. The already dead embryo clutching the IUD. Going home to her sweet marriage. And, of course, about sex on Rowan's sofa.
Per sfizio, for fun. These warming days, Susan attacks the garden. She's been waiting to approach the limonaia, the lemon's wintering over house, though there are now no lemon trees. She intends to remedy that as soon as she cleans out the long stone room. Grazia said to throw away everything, but Susan will keep the rusty round table, the battered tin watering cans, the arches that appear in the dining room fresco, and the faded green metal chairs. She takes before pictures for the garden design blog she started. Lightly sanded and given a clear, opaque coat of protection, the vintage furniture will look natural for summer dinners under the pergola. Leo says the wooden table, rather rickety, easily can be fixed up for dining among the lemons and oranges. Susan wipes down the surface, deciding to coat it later with a light gray wash. Grazia has no idea these things, even the watering cans, cost a fortune in French antique markets. Leo, who remembers how glorious the limonaia was when he was a boy, volunteers to help.
I used to walk in just to breathe the perfume. There must have been 30 lemons back then, all in the old-style pale terracotta pots. Tito and my father moved them outside in early May, took them in before hard frost. In summer, they stood along the drive.
Facciamo ancora. Let's do that again.
Susan hopes her Italian isn't atrocious, because it has a sexy sound. Also, Susan will not toss out the green glass wine demijohns, still covered in woven osier. She slices off the rotten baskets to reveal sensuous emerald globes, curved like Kit's new belly. Leo shows her how to clean out the grotty inside. He puts in a couple of handfuls of small stones with soap, then squirts in water. The tricky part is sloshing the bottle around without it slipping out of your hands as the rocks scour the glass. He rinses several times. Susan will make one flower bed featuring these bottles. Some raised on stone bases at different heights, she decides. She sweeps, de-cobwebs with a broom, lugs dirty flower pots outside and hoses them off. In her business, Susan has been on the hiring end of whipping property into shape. Oddly, she finds that she's loving this work. The three cats pounce on dust balls and sniff the corners of the limonaia.
Ah, you can move out here for the summer, Susan tells them. You too, Archie. Get out of that trash pile.
Here's the worst job. She attacks the filthy stone floor, first with a push broom, then with hose and scrub brush. The cats run into the bushes. At this point, Camille and Julia, watching from the kitchen, take pity and change into jeans and rubber boots. Cleaning the limonaia's front of iron and glass doors uses all the rags, window cleaner, and vinegar they have. The wavy glass shines. With the three of them working over 3 days, and Leo repairing a side wall of sagging shelves, the limonaia takes shape. The glass-fronted building becomes a garden room, potting shed, rainy day spot for lunch. Susan points to the end section. Camille, there's all this room. We could close off that last third for studio space. You could work with the doors open and step out into the garden when you want. The light is spectacular. Camille opens the doors.
Are you serious? I will die and go to heaven.
Immediately, she has a premonition of working on large canvases. Julia scrapes open the door of the pizza oven, close to the kitchen.
Leo, do you think this works?
It was so overgrown with ivy they'd hardly noticed it until Susan had two men clearing last week.
Certo.
Leo shines his phone light inside, pokes his head in to inspect the intact brick dome and the smooth floor of the oven.
Luisa used to make bread. We must build a fire to season it again before we start shoveling in the pizza. No one has used it in years but spiders.
Susan already has arranged for the delivery of three large potted lemon trees, a kumquat loaded with fruit, and two oranges. They will live inside around the wooden table until all chance of frost is over. More citrus must come, she knows.
Unbelievable, Julia says, as the nurserymen arrange pots around the table. This is just fabulous.
Now the air is suffused with the divine fragrance of white waxy blooms.
It's 60 degrees. Let's eat out here tonight. We can plug in a couple of our bathroom space heaters. I'll line the back ledge of the wall with candles. Leo, can you and Anita come? I'll make the lemon pistachio pasta we all love.
In that case, I need to fix that wobbly table leg.
From the upstairs storage room in the house, Susan, up early, hauls down four mismatched dining chairs, handmade baskets, and wooden wine boxes to the limonaya. She stacks the boxes to make shelves for small pots and hangs the baskets around the new outdoor dining room. Three green demijohns catch the light along the glass doors. Last night, she ordered an outdoor rug from an Italian website, wide gray and white stripes, to go under the table. The whole middle of the limonaya stays free for her workspace. She needs a potting table. She'll buy a new shovel and shiny new clippers and trowels. Time to start seeds.
Julia, let's go to town. Market day, she calls.
Coming,
Julia answers from the open window. She's talking to Chris, catching him up on the Wade development.
That's off your agenda. But thanks for setting this in motion. I'm glad he's going, and I'm not. Hope that doesn't sound selfish. I just can't. I've put my hand down on that hot burner too many times.
Chris texts his flight details. He'll land in Rome in 3 weeks, stopping in San Rocco for a couple of days en route to Venice, where he's meeting the Friuli group.
We'll reconfirm all the Friuli reservations and get some time to talk about the Sicily tour for next year, he says. Mostly, I want to sit in the piazza with you and look around at those mellow buildings and hear you laugh.
After Friuli ends, he's back in Tuscany for a few days before the usual Tuscany group arrives.
It's been ages. Will we recognize each other? I'll take care of all the reconfirming. That's what you hired me for.
Julia is putting on her shoes. I've got to go. Susan is dying to go buy a shovel.
A shovel?
You will not believe what she's done with the limonaya. That woman is formidable.
Talk later.
Can't wait.
Me too. And I hired you for more nefarious reasons, as you well know.
Bougainvillea, grapes, prickly pear. A place to hide. The blissful climate imparts a godlike joy, waking to the scent of orange blossoms and temperature that says, "You're mine, don't worry. I always will caress you like this." The poems I am writing, seem as natural as bougainvillea blossoms blowing into the hallway. The fragrant air alone makes me feel rocked in the cradle. Above me, the blue dome resembles a glazed, inverted china teacup. Capri, a maze of paths. Soon I am on not a walk, but a plunge, down, 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 happily, scarily, vertiginously. One of Capri's primordial appeals, scale. In a lifetime, I could know the island as well as I know Colin's body. Know each carob, every stone wall with blooming capers, all the outbreaks of yellow broom. The houses, curved roofs for catching water, offer views of corkscrew paths, a transparent sea layered with emerald, lapis, turquoise water, so clear that your mind seems equally clear. Move into one of the white houses, and soon I would be painting the walls blue, setting a pot of basil by the door to keep out the bugs, and napping away the hot hours under an arbor. After 6 months here, I might emerge, finally, as a disciplined writer. I would develop iron calf muscles. Glamorous Capri, long a bolt hole for outcasts and those fleeing scandal. The surprise, the tourist-clogged island offers solitude. Away from the main scene, you're faced with paradiso. Lentisk, prickly pear, pine, asphodel, myrtle. Were they planted by the sirens who tried to lure Odysseus with their songs? He was so tempted that his sailors had to lash him to the mast and sail on. What comprises the essence of this place? Guidebooks don't tell me. But the waves on the rocks tell me. The fisherman's blue shirt shouts it out. The delicate shadow of an almond tree on a white wall scrawls three angular black reasons. Capri, combing the island, inhaling the sun-baked scents of wild mint, lemon, and the sea, making love in a mother-of-pearl light, joking with the woman chopping weeds along her fence, memorizing a tumble of pink and apricot bougainvillea intertwining on a rough white wall, picnicking on a pebble beach, and Colin leaning to catch a hot grape I toss toward his open mouth. We're as glam as Jackie in the round sunglasses, skinny Frank Sinatra, insouciant Cary Grant, or so we feel. Colin in his rolled-up white pants, me in a billowing yellow sundress. The island lets you know that you live a charmed life. I see it in Julia, Camille, and Susan, putting their feet down to measure for sandals on Anna Capri, then hailing a convertible taxi and letting their hair fly. Meeting them in the piazza where they've already ordered crazy drinks involving blood orange juice, bitters, and gin. Camille has put her streaky blonde hair up into a twist. I take a photo and send it to Rowan. Julia has bought Carthusian monk's soaps shaped like lemons for Susan, who has found a shop that makes exquisite baby clothes. I suspect she has found something for our little voyager. Those three have the number one quality of great travelers, curiosity. And they have fun. We all came down on the fast train from Florence to Naples, then over to the island on the hydrofoil. There in a posh house Brian and Nicola will be featuring on their rental site. Susan already has copious notes on what the Swiss owners need to do to upgrade it into a luxury rental. Get rid of the fake flowers. Better tableware. Who wants cheap white plates and straw mats at this price? We are here for 4 nights in the blessed season before mass tourism descends. This will be my last trip before what they horrendously call confinement. I'm almost 7 months now. Colin was able to get away for this blissful escape. Even if you don't need a respite, Capri offers one. I've been before, only once, and in July, when the crush of humanoids around is pure hell. But no one in the designer shops. By 4 o'clock, fairies tootle away, leaving a manageable crowd. At cocktail hour, you can convince yourself of your sophistication and beauty under any bar's awning on the piazza. At their luxurious villa, Grazzi Nicola, with a long terrace looking over the Faraglioni rocks and a sweep of the sea, Julia is shelling new peas. She has found a local woman to work with her and who will serve us at a table with a view so stupendous that I don't want to eat. Just stare out at the lights twinkling toward Naples. I walk over to the wall overlooking the waters, pulling my shawl around me, relishing the taut roundness of my body. To be pregnant with the person you love, what can compare? To stand over this grand sweep of water, to know that you love, you can love, you can live with your love. Colin rubs his face against my neck. Are you okay? Then he steps up to the evening, helping serve Julia's baked olives with capers, her mozzarella skewers layered with sun-dried tomatoes and basil, and after drinks, pasta shells stuffed with shrimp, peas, and 3 cheeses. Camille comes out of the kitchen with 2 more bottles of the local thin wine. Colin, and you 3 gorgeous graces. We've come this far as a pergola with bunches of dangling grapes. Grappola, a bunch. The tactile word makes you want to reach up and grab one. I see Julia reach for her pad and jot down the word, an entry for her learning Italian. Yes, yes, Colin says. Still, Kit and I have a long way to go. I'm thinking of the next 2 months. But tonight will be divine. Colin sets up his speaker out on the patio and plays all the versions of Nessun Dorma that we love. He's made a pitcher of lemonade with mint and gamely drinks with me. I don't miss wine at this point. Imagining Miss Pris getting high keeps me mindful. We dance as the constellations perform their arrangements. The 7 sisters, my favorite. The Big Dipper pouring blessings over this island. Colin must hold me almost at arm's length, like 19th century waltzers. My beach ball. Our churner in his own blue grotto. I love Capri. For good reasons, we aesthetes and day trippers migrate here for a whiff of the air gods breathe. Back at our B&B, long after midnight, I'm still awake. No moon, but the sky radiates a filmy white afterglow. Nightingales are calling from the shrubbery. From poems, I always imagined a piercing, repetitive sweetness. What I'm hearing sounds like the station keeps getting switched. Someone must have counted the number of sound patterns and at what intervals they reoccur. One chatters like a squirrel. One sounds like hammering tacks. Others do have that sweetness I expected. What a double dealer. I think I'm laughing as I fall asleep. Mornings, I write, and Colin sketches ideas for a pavilion, cafe, and museum on the water in Key West, polar opposite of Capri. On our warm afternoons, Colin walks the steep paths, and I lounge on our patio reading South Wind by Norman Douglas, a pederast who preyed on local boys. Creepy he was, but can he ever write an evocative description of the island? I skip around, finding words and phrases to admire. Otherwise, easy to fall into a lovely siesta with the sun on my feet and bougainvillea blurring orange to pink to magenta in front of the distant Tyrrhenian Sea. The faraway slosh of waves repeats, repeats, Tyrrhenian, Tyrrhenian. On the ferry back to Naples, my back starts to ache in a strange way, as though I am being pushed. I'm only carrying a light bag. Colin juggles the two carry-ons. I'm hot, and no one else is. I found a seat and let the strong breeze blow on my face. We board the fast train to Florence. In the bathroom, I feel weak. A streak of pale blood stains my underwear. When I return to my seat, Colin is deep into his files, but he jumps up. What's wrong, babes? You look sick. Are you okay? When we get to Florence, we need to go to my doctor ASAP. Could you call her? I tell him about the blood. I'm by the window and can hide my face. I don't want to move. I cup my arms under my baby. Stay. Stay. Colin keeps his arm around me and with his free hand starts looking up symptoms on his phone.
Are you sure your water didn't break?
I can see in his eyes the horrifying prospect of delivering the baby on the train. No, I say, trying to be calm. A little smear of blood, and my sides ache. Just then, lightning bolts of pain shoot down my diaphragm into my legs. He leaves a message for the nurse. Emergency will arrive around 14:30. Glancing over at Colin's screen, I see placenta previa and normal start to labor. The attendant offers drinks, and I order a Coke, thinking it might calm my insides, my mother's remedy. Shortly, I'm throwing up in the bathroom. Julia saw me pass down the aisle and followed. Are you all right? She knocks. I say, fine, yes, fine, no, not fine, and unlock the door. Something's weird. We've called the doctor. I tell her about the blood and the ache. I'm remembering the narrow-pathed climb to their aerie on Capri, hauling myself up steps and leaning on the rail, the fleeting thought that maybe I shouldn't, then descending late as we walked back to our place, a kind of extending that my knees and back seemed to rebel against. Later, I was okay. You are going to be fine. These things happen all the time. I know it's scary. They don't happen all the time in the last 3 months. Well, sometimes. And sex can cause bleeding. Let's don't go there. We'll come with you. No, Colin will. But how can you get to San Rocco? Colin has left his car at the train station parking garage. I'll call Gianni right now, not to worry. You'll let us know? The doctor's exam showed the baby's rapid heartbeat. The bleeding stopped, then started up again with clots. I was hooked to an IV. We'll spare you my nightmares. She kept me overnight at the hospital. Colin blamed himself, but I assured him that we are allowed to make love. Though privately, something about that begins to seem a bit eldritch to me. When I woke up this morning, I felt light cramps, like when you're about to get your period. When Dr. Caprini calls around, she says I can leave late today, if there's no more bleeding, but that she wants me to stay in bed at home now. I can prop up in a chair, take showers, but she warns, no activity. We have to see if this baby wants out now. Stay, I will. Stay, biddy she, he.
in place.
Look on the bright side, Colin begins. I cut him off. No, the bright side is not that I get to concentrate on writing. If this hadn't happened, I could do that anyway. And you'll have to cook. We're going to be having a lot of grilled cheese. I'll willingly stay prone if it helps the baby come to normal term. I can read. Camille says she'll give me drawing lessons. I can work on my friend's project and on Margaret. I can watch Spanish telenovelas, which is what I flat out want to do. I'm shaken to the core. As Colin is whistling while he cooks, I'm weeping into my pillow. Colin's chicken isn't bad, but it isn't good. Julia will come through for us. She's already brought over 6 jars of her frozen ragu. When you have ragu, you have dinner. Said she'll be back later with minestrone.
Immigrant energy. I feel okay, but tentative. A day spent ordering my desk is a good day. No lifting, even dictionaries. In the stack of mail, I find a letter with a Richmond return address. Confident, blocky print, real ink. Calhoun Green. Not sure I can take Margaret drama today. I prop it on the windowsill and look out at my row of roses just coming into leaf along the tall stone wall. Albertine, my good coral pink climber. Queen Elizabeth, who can't decide if she's a climber or just unruly. Decadent Eden, a.k.a. Pierre de Ronsard. And Alberic Barbia, the scrappy one that presents tight yellow buds, only to open to the color of vanilla gelato. I must give Susan cuttings of all these. When they're in full bloom, will I be walking my baby along the wall? Little bundle in a blanket, breathing in first ever rose scents. Another life. Meanwhile, I send out new poems to magazines, organize my Margaret files, and answer emails. Here's a tempting invitation to read in Nashville in October. Babe will be 4 months. Hard to commit when I have no idea what our lives will look like by then. London? Miami? Here? I pull my silky throw around me, stack 2 pillows, and turn on Grand Hotel. Fitzy usually practices Olympian disdain, but now jumps onto the bed and stretches his silky white body along mine. Animal instinct. May his purr lull my restless bambino. Changes cause changes. A letter dropped into a slot. A reply.
Dear Ms. Rain, thank you for sending the letter you found among Margaret's papers. You cannot imagine the impact. You must have struggled with whether to send such news to me, news withheld for many years. I could have never known of the existence of Colin, his birth, his life, his death. These have landed upon me with devastating sadness. Only a brief time has passed. How this all will settle, I don't know. May I say clearly, letting Margaret walk out of my life was the mistake I will regret forever. In my hard head, I knew she was more than I could manage. Mine was a destined life. I thought at the time, a clear and regulated life, one handed down like monogrammed silver. At 20, I wanted that. I loved the place I came from and my family's values. She was born to rove, to think big, to risk. She was a rip-roaring girl, iconoclastic, challenging.
She scared me then. Now, this. I see how much stronger she was. That the